Welcome. Thank you for coming to the launch of the Oxford Martin Commission for Future Generations. I'm Ian Golden. I'm the director of the Oxford Martin School and the vice chair of the commission, and I'm delighted to be joined on this panel by our chairman, Pascal Lamy, by Julia Martin Lefebvre, the president, director general of the International Union of Conservation, Roland Berger, the founder of Roland Berger Associates, Mo Ibrahim, businessman and civil society activist and founder of the Mo Ibrahim Prize, Lord Nick Stern of Brentford, who is not only a Lord, but of course a leading academic as well, and Lord Martin Rees, who is also not only a leading academic, but has former president of the Royal Society and Astronomer Royal. We are a subset of the 19 commissioners that you will see in your documentation, the full list of this. I'm going to very briefly explain why we started this commission. I'm going to give the floor to Pascal Lamy, who will highlight some of the overall structural issues we dealt with and broad conclusions. Then I'm going to ask each of the commissioners in turn to very briefly highlight one or two of the recommendations before we open it up to discussion. The background to this is that the Oxford Martin School was founded by James Martin, who very sadly died while this report was underway, who had a vision of humanity being at the crossroads, that we live in a century which will either be our best century ever, where we lead long, healthy lives, and our children and grandchildren do, or it could well be our worst, because we're unable to grapple with the many pressing challenges which we know about but are unable to meet in terms of the responses. And it's this gap between knowledge and action which very much comes to the fore in the work at Oxford University within the Oxford Martin School of about 350 people working across the board from the frontiers of medicine and the physical and life sciences, energy, climate change, social sciences and issues like migration and finance. This gap between knowledge and action, we feel, is growing because the pressing challenges that are arising out of globalization are growing. The need for action is growing, and yet the response is not there. The commission was constituted to try and bring people together that had a very deep experience, in having thought about these issues, having managed global institutions, having been at the forefront of trying to get things done in one way or another, either succeeded and some of us have failed in our attempts. But what we have in common is this experience. And what we also have is a very broad diversity, and you'll see in your list of commissioners in the documentation, senior Chinese minister responsible for planning and economic reform in China, senior Indian minister, one of the presidential candidates in Chile, Michelle Bachelet, and many others. So we were looking for geographical diversity, and we were looking for diversity as well in skill sets, people from the world of business, people from the world of academia, including Nobel Prize winner Amartya Sen, and people from these institutions. Our choice of chair, we were very fortunate when looking, and I've known Pascal for a very long time since he was Trade Commissioner in Europe and I was working on the Uruguay round. We wanted someone who was deeply knowledgeable about the global governance system, had worked for a long time in it in different capacities, and thought across these issues. And we were extremely fortunate when Pascal agreed to be chair, and indeed when all these commissioners agreed to work with us over this last year. It's been a short, intense period of work. We've drawn very heavily on the academics in Oxford that are part of the Oxford Martin School, and I do want to extend my thanks to them for the time given. I also want to extend my thanks to the wonderful secretariat we've had, led by Natalie Day, who've carried a lot of the load in making this happen. I won't spend too much on thanks, although so many are due. But I do want to now give the floor to Pascal and ask him to introduce the report. Thank you.
Thank you, Jan. As you just said, what brought us together for this work, which we started roughly a year ago, is a common view, worry about too much short-termism in governance, in business, even in civil society, but also a common experience of pragmatism. So we all agree that there is too much short-termism, that we should look more long-term, but we all agree that we shouldn't do that the sort of utopian way. So this is not a report about how can we, should we build a better future. We know we have to build a better future in many respects. The only question is, how do you do that? And this is, I think, the thrust of this endeavor. It's no different from previous reports and next reports about future generations in the sort of scene setting. We have spotted what we call mega trends, which are what we believe are the shaping factors of the future, whether technology, whether demographics, whether social issues, whether geopolitics. The scene setter is not, again, ice-breaking on the challenges which humanity has to face long-term and the necessity to address them. As Jan said, that will make the difference between the best or the worst of the centuries. Where we innovate, or where we have decided to innovate, in the solution. So we know the problem. What megatrends and challenges tell us is that we know a lot about these challenges and the solution to these challenges. What's missing is not the knowledge, what's missing is the action. And the issue is, how do you move, how do you build this bridge between a lot of knowledge and very little action? In order to do that, we've gone the good old Oxford science way, and we've taken roughly 20 topics, examples of what worked and what did not work in terms of addressing properly global challenges for the last 3-4 decades. Why did HIV/AIDS work, let's say, reasonably, and oceans depletion not work? Why did Y2K work reasonably, and why does climate change not really work? Why did the Mexican crisis or the Asian financial crisis of the end of the 90s work? Why is it so painful to exit this time, the financial crisis that started in 08. Why did the single market work in Europe at the beginning of the 90s, and why is the do-around still many ways stalled? So, facts, experiences, which we've analyzed, again, desiccated the Oxford way, and the great thing about the Oxford Martin School is that, like the Commission, you've got people who are world summits on physics and nanotechnologies and banking and communication, and so that's extremely rich, which has allowed us to draw a number of principles from looking at what works and what doesn't work. Of course, the next step being, let's try and make proposals and address this knowledge action gap in borrowing to what worked and not to what didn't work, which seems fairly logical. And then from there, we draw a number of principles. We identify why there is this problem, and it's now pretty clear, at least in our mind. We have problems with institutions, we have problems with engagement, trust in politics. We, of course, have problems with the growing complexity which globalization brings. We have problems with a lot of cultural sort of biases that prevent humans who have the same long-term problem to see it the same way, and even if they see it the same way, they have a very different view of what the sequence is, which is, for instance, why you have the Indian government is using a rate of actualization of 12 to 13%, and the American Environment Agency is using a discount rate of 2%, which says a lot about these, you know, still remaining differences. And in order to test the validity of our findings, we then, and that's the last part of the report, make a number of suggestions that in no way pretend to be exhaustive. We don't have a sort of proposed solution and how to get there for each and every of these big challenges. But we take examples of things which we believe are different from what has been done so far and could work. We propose the creation of a WorldStat, which is a sort of a statistical cloud for the planet, which would be accessible and which would trigger more technical assistance for a number of countries where the necessary data are still missing. We propose a sort of CyberX, which is a platform, again, something somewhere in the cloud, that would help gathering the knowledge and awareness of cyber security issues, whether on the side of attack or whether on the side of data privacy issues. We propose to try and address climate change through what we call the C20, C30, C40, C being 20 countries, C30 being 30 big multinationals, C40 being 40 big megapoles on this planet. The notion being that from the experience we've drawn from the past, if we can set up a coalition between 20 countries, 30 multinationals, and 40 cities, then the critical mass to mobilize enough political energy to address climate change and carbon emission reductions could be there. So I'm just giving a few examples. There are many of these. Next step being, of course, to submit this, we hope, innovative sort of bit of ice breaking solutions, proposals, which of course came from very diverse horizons and continents, and which were all represented in the Commission, including the Chinese planning minister, including the Indian minister, who's in charge of providing 1.3 billion Indians with a digital identity. So very diverse experiences. What we try to do is, again, break this well-known gridlock, which many of us have experienced in national, regional, or global governance, in institutions, in business, in civil society, and we believe that cross-constituency initiatives of this kind, if sustained by governments, by civil society, by business, could do a lot to reduce discount rate, which we believe in many ways is far too high, although, of course, this depends very much on the topic you consider.
Thank you very much, Pascal. Just before giving the floor to Lord Nicholas Stern, I'd just like to confirm that this is being live webcast, so what we're saying will hopefully travel around the world. And we also are encouraging a Twitter conversation. For those of you that are online, the hashtag is long-term now. Nick.
Thank you very much, Pascal and Ian. Just for academic transparency, I should emphasize that we have diversity of universities. LSE, Cambridge, Harvard, National University of Singapore, and the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine all represented cheerfully with Oxford on this panel. And my very good friend on my right is former president of the Royal Society. I'm currently president of the British Academy. So we got that out of the way. I'm asked to speak on what we mean by decades, not days, and very quickly on discounting, and do it all in 4 minutes. So I'll speak quickly and you better listen carefully. Basically, if people make investments in many parts of infrastructure, but not just infrastructure, they're looking out 20, 30, 40 years as investors, because that's how long much of this capital stock lasts, some cases even longer than that. And the biggest, in many cases, the biggest disincentive to invest is government-induced policy risk. You don't know where government policies will be going. So it's government policies and their volatility that induces short-termism. And so what we've tried to do is to respond to that problem by looking at institutional structures which can reduce uncertainty. Analogies in medicine would be, you know, National Institute for Clinical Excellence, which is public, which is democratically established, democratically accountable, but looks carefully on a basis of its own logical rules and scientific analysis at evidence to make recommendations. And you contrast that with a Minister of Health in a hurry, subject to all sorts of pressures, and I think many of us would consider that sort of considered, measured, careful, evidence-based view of decision-making, accountable, of course, is a better way of taking long-term decisions. We give the example of the infrastructure, Australia, infrastructure, Singapore, which have gone some way to providing that. Other examples, the Office for Budget Responsibility, independent central banks, and so on. So this is a way of reducing government-induced policy risk and thus reducing short-termism in investment. There are other ways in which we look at short-termism too, in terms of private sector and accounting and the way things are reported. So that's decades, not days. On discounting, we look directly at how you should, and this is an ethical question clearly, so reasonable people can differ, but we're all reasonable people and we took a common view, and that is that you should treat people similarly, notwithstanding their date of birth. You can vote when you're over 18, that your vote is not weighted by whether you're 20 or 40. You can appear in front of a jury and you should be treated the same according to what age you are, and indeed membership of the jury subject to some age constraints, but subject to a very wide limit. Taxation of 25-year-olds and 45-year-olds is similar. We treat people in those contexts equally, and many constitutions are after just that idea of equal treatment. So we took the view, as an ethical position, but one which is justified by most basic philosophical positions and in most constitutions, that you should not discriminate between people by date of birth. And that is a fundamentally important story. Secondly, you have to think about how well off people in the future will be, because we are used to attaching lower weight to an extra pound or dollar to somebody who is rich relative to somebody who is poor. Again, that's a normal value judgment in public discussion, and one to which many people would aspire, and it's standard in many policy discussions. So discounting will depend on, in other words, how much less or more weight you attach to something that accrues 40 or 50 years down the track relative to now, will depend on what we think about how well off or badly off those people will be. And that's the critical issue when it comes to discounting, not discrimination by date of birth. We could do things now, and this is the now in the title of this report, we could do things now which could make people 50 or 100 or 150 years from now much worse off than now. And we have to take that into account in thinking about how we evaluate the future and our actions now. So much of these issues have big dangers of delay, and hence the title of this report, Now for the Long Term, and hence the concern for institutional structures that limit the damage done to long-termism by government policy, limit those in a democratic way, and hence careful thinking about how you treat people who happen to have been born at different dates. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Mo?
Thanks, Ian. One of the areas which I'm asked to speak on from among the outputs of the board, the area of the openness of government. Technology always is a problem. Really, we need to renew the trust.
You've got two mics, so I'll take this one away.
Okay. A mic, I forgot the mic. Thanks. We need really to renew the trust between people and governments through more trust.
The sound is not coming out, is it? Is your mic on?
It's okay now.
Is it okay?
Is this how it's coming?
Okay.
You want this one?
Yeah.
Okay.
You turn the other one off?
Yeah. Meaning, you know, to be a lord doesn't mean you're always right. Sorry.
Sometimes it's good.
Now, there is an issue here about transparency, really, and of course, corruption, etc. The need, really, for more transparent and open government, a new trust, really, need to be built between citizens and governments. More open data became a huge issue now. And in that context, actually, I want to say one or two things about the open government partnership. I don't know if you heard about this. That body was established last year. It's very interestingly, it was pioneered, actually spearheaded by Brazil, South Africa, Indonesia, joined by United States and the United Kingdom. And but since then, there was more than 58 or 60 countries which signed up. The body actually is equally funded by the private sector, interestingly, and civil society, and by the government themselves. So it's a true partnership. And the objective of this is really for governments to sign on a commitment to open up and to subject itself to an independent audit run by this partnership. I happen to be one of the three, what they call them, independent advisors with two wonderful ladies, Graça Machel from Mozambique and South Africa, and Mary Robinson from Ireland. And in few days, actually, the first six reports will come out. Among them will be the report on the UK. Please check to see if UK is really open or not. The government is really opening. These are independent reports to really measure openness of this government and its transparency. You'll be surprised that we found most of the governments actually do not publish most of their budgets. And I'm talking about big governments in what is called the developed democratic Western world. So that is an interesting issue. What we call in the in our commission here for more governments to join. We don't understand that countries like France, for example, is not yet member. Germany is not yet member. We need to ask the question why you guys are not interested in transparency. Open government, what is the problem with you? We need also institutions, more institutions to subject itself to such openness. All these public institutions funded by public money, there need to be some audit also on the way they conduct their business and they, their openness. Actually, we go further. We suggest that maybe we should start some form of an index to really measure the commitment to the long term in our governments, businesses, and institutions. And one of the proposals here is to create that sort of index. Probably the home should be at the Oxford Martin School, because I think it needs to be run by independent academic body, but also a partnership with civil society, business, governments, whoever want to partnership in that. It should be an open process. And we need to really track and start to point the finger. I think that will be also a useful way to keep people honest. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Mo, for talking about open governance and the index that we're proposing. I'd now like to ask Julia Martin-Lefebvre to talk about our coalition proposal and fit for purpose.
Thank you very much. Following on what Nick Stern said, just to be transparent, our commission is more gender balanced than it looks here, so I'm not the only woman. I'm glad that I could come. The other thing is that I don't represent a university, but a very interesting large coalition already of all the governments in the world and 1,000 NGOs. That's the International Union for Conservation of Nature. So I want to highlight two specific recommendations of our report found in the last section entitled Practical Futures. And these relate to creative coalitions and better functioning institutions. How do we do things better? So we felt that this was very important, as the present way of addressing global problems is simply not fit for future, for either reflection or action on solutions that will bring results and be valid not only for us but for future generations. So on the one hand, therefore, we are proposing a coalition between countries, companies, and cities to together discuss and find doable solutions that counteract the climate change problem. So we've named this coalition C20, C30, C40. Pascal referred to it, and it's intended to kickstart the process leading to the very important climate conference of the parties that will be held in Paris in 2015. And the idea is that this coalition consists of already existing coalitions. So the C20 refers to the G20 group of countries. The C30 refers to 30 of the large businesses that are already a part of the World Business Council on Sustainable Development, which was established in 1992 at the Earth Summit. And the C40 refers to a coalition of the mega cities of the world that was started here in London in 2005. And the idea is that this is the obvious thing to happen, that these countries, companies, and cities would work together on common challenges, and to start with that of climate change. And so we expect this coalition to deliver specific targets on things like improved transport systems, energy-saving buildings, reduction in waste, and so on. And as you can see, this is very, very doable. And what we're also suggesting is that maintaining membership in the C20, C30, C40 coalition should depend on performance and a transparent disclosure process. You've heard the word transparent already several times, and that strong performance should be recognized. Now, I have to say that I think we should start with this coalition, but we should add another C, and that is civil society. And that, of course, such a coalition should and could address other global issues, the loss of biodiversity, water issues, the ocean issues, and so on. It would be set up to do that. And the second thing that I want to point to is that we also looked at existing international institutions, which everyone knows, many of them were set up 60 years ago, built very well for yesterday, and absolutely lacking the capacity to address long-term issues. So we said in Part B of our report that the culture of working in short-term silos describes most present-day institutions. So what do? We, I think, had the courage to address the very painful questions of whether these institutions are actually fit for purpose. That is, whether they're able to address our present-day challenges in a way that will bring results to future generations. So we took note of the fact that the number of UN and Bretton Woods institutions has steadily grown since their founding. The UN itself today has over 20 independent agencies with greatly overlapping mandates. I went to a big World Water Summit last week in Budapest, and the first day of that summit started with a very good address by the Secretary General of the UN, followed by about a half a dozen heads of UN agencies, all of whom were saying the same thing. And I can tell you that most normal people in the audience went out for coffee because they just didn't understand the need for such a repetition. So in our report, we noted that while mandates may have changed somewhat, not one agency has come even close to being gracefully retired. We also note that there is no system of a constructive review of publicly funded international institutions paid for by our taxes, which have therefore failed to keep pace with the challenging nature of the issues that we're addressing. So we recommend in our report the inclusion of sunset clauses into the governance structures of these international institutions. So this is meant not to automatically close them down, or some of them down, but to ensure that there is a regular reflection and analysis of organizational performance and purpose to encourage institutions to be more innovative in their capacity to respond to the demands of the future. We recommend that such reflection and analysis again be transparent and inclusive, and where it is shown that an institution has fulfilled its mandate, they should be allowed to close very nicely down, and with the resources of those activities that need to be continued, redirected to more appropriate institutions. This is actually not revolutionary, it's doable, and thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Julia. Martin Rees, who will briefly reflect on our recommendations on CyberX and making our numbers count.
Well, I'm going to discuss two new institutions which we recommend, and I'm very glad that Julia has mentioned that we hope that this could be compensated by perhaps eliminating some superfluous or obsolete ones. But the first of the new ones we want to recommend is called WorldStat, and its aim is to raise the quality of global statistics by assessing present practices, regulating misuse, and improving data collection. And it's very important, of course, because unless all countries gather and publish reliable data, international comparisons of economic growth, health, life expectancies, and so forth can't be relied on, and they can't form a basis for government action. And indeed, the paucity of economic data in some countries, especially in Africa, makes it difficult to understand the true levels of inequality and significant drivers. And we can't properly assess the effectiveness of governments and international organizations unless there are reliable performance indicators. And they help us to focus attention on good governance, to incentivize it, and incentivize efforts to reduce corruption and waste. And this is, of course, Mo Ibrahim's prime concern. Well, WorldStat would not be a substitute for existing institutions such as the UN Statistical Commission or its Statistical Division, but it would complement their work by focusing on implementing agreed standards, improving the capabilities for archiving and interpreting data, especially in the developing world. And we imagine it would be a separate entity with a budget and resources comparable to Eurostat. And WorldStat could also fast-track international efforts to adopt appropriate and robust indicators for sustainable development. And we highlight in particular, and Mo Ibrahim would do this too, the need to devise a long-term impact index, which could comprehensively measure a country's long-term progress. And the next step would be to work with existing organizations to decide how WorldStat should be funded and to which bodies it would be accountable. So that's the first new institution. The second one is concerned with cyber issues. When Obama met the new Chinese leader earlier this year, cybersecurity was high on the agenda, and the potential for cybercrime and cyber aggression is a growing threat at all levels, from the lone hacker up to state level. The digital world is relatively unconstrained by national boundaries, and it's not very well regulated. Threats emerging from cyberspace are considered one of the most serious economic and national security challenges which states are going to face in the coming decades. Cyber warfare has a low entry cost, completely in contrast, for instance, to the elaborate challenge of making nuclear weapons. So the cyber domain will become a favored arena for asymmetric warfare. And cyber criminals will operate via places where cyber protection is inadequately developed. This is particularly the case in Africa and South America, where the technology, of course, is spreading fast. But it's not just a concern in developing countries. There was a recent report which said that 4 in 5 of the UK's largest quoted companies aren't properly prepared for cyber attacks. And citizens are becoming increasingly skeptical of the ability of governments, businesses, banks and other service providers to protect their data security. Cybersecurity is handicapped by inconsistent rules across different networks and systems. So our Commission recommends the establishment of a new independent agency called CyberX to identify and counter emerging common threats. And the initiative could build on existing national response systems while also supporting developing countries where the cyber infrastructure is weakest. CyberX could be funded by participating stakeholders, but it would be crucial to ensure that it is a trusted platform and it would share information on global cyber systems, weaknesses, suspicious internet traffic, and malicious software, and help countries and businesses to protect against cyber attacks. And CyberX could help governments, businesses and individuals to understand the common threat patterns better and identify preventative measures and minimize future attacks. And that's why we feel it's another worthwhile recommendation that we can make, although it would involve setting up a new agency.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Martin. And now I'll give the floor to Dr. Roland Berger, founder of Roland Berger Associates Management Consulting, to talk about some of our business dimensions in the recommendations.
Thank you very much. I'm going to mention two of our recommendations which refer to transparent taxation, the first one, and the second one to a more long-term focus of businesses. In order to help harmonize company taxation arrangements, promote information sharing, and enhance transparency, the Commission recommends the establishment of a voluntary world taxation and regulatory exchange. The aim of the exchange would be to encourage multinational corporations to disclose their tax planning and transfer pricing arrangements, either confidentially or on the record, and for governments to reveal rulings on preferential tax regimes. The Fiscal Affairs Department of the IMF could be considered as a possible site for the exchange, which could enhance information sharing between tax administrations internationally, and raise public pressures on tax abuse and avoidance schemes. The exchange is extended to reinforce the overall framework of the OECD G20 Base Erosion and Profit Sharing Action Plan to ensure that multinationals pay their fair share of tax and that profits generated in the digital economy are not unfairly and artificially shifted to other jurisdictions, such as Google did recently by shifting $9 billion of taxes due to the Bermudas and escape taxes this way. Therefore, the exchange is intended to be voluntary, such that collective pressure is generated by increased transparency and by companies electing to set an example. As anticipated by the OECD G20 project, such commitments could be formalized in due course by a multinational instrument. The second issue I would like to address is the focus on the long term. The Commission urges that priority be given to implementing the recommendations made by the Group of 30 on long-term finance, particularly the proposals surrounding long-term accounting frameworks, development of infrastructure for capital markets in developing countries, and the redirection of structural surpluses in national savings to diversified sovereign wealth funds with a long-term investment mandate. In particular, the Commission believes that G30's call for the creation of dedicated long-term financial institutions should be prioritized. This requires the public and private sectors to work together to establish lending institutions and investment intermediaries with long-term mandates. Such institutions could include infrastructure banks, green finance, small business banks, and innovation funds, whereby funding is provided directly through a public sector institutions or indirectly through guarantees to the private sector. On a related front, the International Accounting Standard Board, the IFRS, could work together with other institutions, of course, to promote longer-term business horizons and potentially develop a health assessment for listed companies. This assessment would concentrate on the long-term value creation and absolute performance, taking into account portfolio churn, remuneration incentives, long-term lengths of investments, shareholder voting rights, organizational talent and tenure, time dedicated to long-term strategy deliberations, and innovative capacity. And it should reduce the pressure of short-term reporting needs, such as quarterly reports. I think this long-term health assessment for corporations could be really an important instrument, which could, over the time, influence also the DNA of corporations, thinking more long-term and being less focused on the short-term and on short-term requirements of capital markets. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Roland. So you've heard from Pascal on the broad principles and the five principles that guided our thinking in throwing these examples up. The creation of creative coalitions, the development of innovative, open and reinvigorated institutions, revaluing the future, investing in younger generations and establishing a common platform of understanding. And you've heard from the commissioners 10 examples, illustrative examples, practical examples of how these may be taken forward. We haven't covered some crucial recommendations, not least those with respect to, for example, youth unemployment and investing in the youth. And I do encourage you to look at those in the report. We'd now like to engage in a conversation with you. If you have particular questions for an individual commissioner, please direct them to the commissioner, and otherwise I will allocate them across. Please also do identify yourself, and remember that what you say is on the record as it's being webcast. Thank you very much. I'll take the gentleman in the front first. Is there a roving mic? Yep.
Thanks very much. Good morning. What an impressive report. My name's Angus Hanton of the Intergenerational Foundation. I just wanted to say we've been producing for the UK for the last 2 years an intergenerational fairness index, and we'd certainly like to input into your index for future. So that's my point. And my question is, do you think there's a tension between democracy and the interests of future generations? Thank you.
I'm going to collect a couple of questions, and then we'll come back to the panel, if we can just keep track of these commissioners. The gentleman immediately behind you.
Thank you. My name's Mike Childs from Friends of the Earth, and very much welcome the report and looking forward to reading it in detail. I've got a question around the C20, C30, C40 critical creative coalition, a critical mass coalition, if you like. And I should kind of preface it by saying I think there is a role for that, and we do think there is a need. For example, we've highlighted the potential role for C40 in global climate conversations. But the question is, what gives you confidence that this grouping can get across the short-term thinking that seems to be prevalent? Because many of those groupings, the G20, for example, haven't managed to get across short-term thinking yet, and I suggest that's probably also the case for the C30.
Thank you. The gentleman in the front here with the red tie.
Jack Giacometti of Giacometti Associates. All your observations are very close to my heart, but actually connecting to the question of the previous gentleman, if you take a C20, 30, 40 initiative, for instance, one will need an extraordinary vehicle to help people focus, really first understanding what the situation on the planet is, and then really to think about and how do we find the ways out. And you need, as you said yourself, you need government, you need the corporate sector, and you need civil society all together. Have you given thought about what sort of extraordinary vehicle you could use? Like, for instance, war games. We are working with the military in this space. If not, then I would welcome any conversations after this session. Thank you.
The woman behind you.
Yes, good morning. Camilla Toulmin, the director of the International Institute for Environment and Development, IID, working on many of these issues for 40 plus years and recognizing the huge complexity of them. When we were in Rio last year, Pascal, you said you felt that multilateralism was very much at a low ebb. What do you think might regenerate an appetite for multilateralism? We've seen a lot of energy coming into the post-2015 debate, but my feeling behind that is that it doesn't have any real bite in terms of domestic national policy. What do you think might be an international global oversight institution that would have the legitimacy and buy-in of global citizens? And how do we kind of break out from the national identities and jurisdictions that stop us very often taking that global view?
Take the gentleman behind you.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Eric Millstone. I work on science and technology policy at the University of Sussex. And I would like to inquire about the proposal that appears on pages 7 and again on 62 concerning social protection measures and breaking intergenerational persistence of poverty. And it recommends conditional transfer, cash transfer programs. But I've looked at this and I can't see what the conditions are that you have in mind, and some clarification from the Commission on that point would be very helpful. Thank you.
Okay. Let's take the gentleman here, the gentleman there, and then we'll come back to the panel. And there will be another round, don't worry.
Thank you. Jakob van Uxkull from the World Future Council, of which Julia Martin-Lefevre is a member. After what Monsieur Lamy said about, you know, the difference between the successes and the failures in international initiatives of the last years, I mean, I think there's a very interesting reason why. You know, there wasn't any strong financial lobby vested interest in computers breaking down in the year 2000, for example. But we're now dealing with issues where there is a huge such interest. And I'm not just talking about, you know, sort of short-term vested lobbyism. We work with policymakers, you know, worldwide, and when we, for example, take up even a simple issue on which I think there's wide agreement across the whole spectrum, the need to abolish subsidies on fossil fuels. But when we propose that to policymakers, we did in Africa a few weeks ago, they said, but if we wanted that, if we worked for that, we'd have a revolution. And if we, as we know, the recent, you know, riots in Nigeria, Jordan, and now in Sudan, when there were even small steps taken in that direction, you know, that, I think, is the real challenge we face. We know what needs to be done to move from theory to action, the policy initiatives we need, but they seem to be not politically feasible in the short term, although they're very necessary in the long term. And how do you envisage contributing to, you know, getting across that gap. Thank you.
It's very much fun. Okay, final to the gentleman over there with the black shirt, and we'll come back to the panel.
So I'm just wondering to what extent we're actually running up against fundamental problems of human nature here, and that, you know, we only each live for so many decades, so it's difficult to plan ahead, and how you really plan to get around that at an institutional level. In particular, I mean, so one of the suggestions that's been made is the idea of sunset clauses for international institutions, which sounds great in theory, but I just wonder, is that going to have exactly the perverse effect of if you assess an institution every few years, they're just going to focus on passing their next assessment and not actually doing anything?
Okay, thanks very much. I'm going to ask Pascal to begin. Some questions were pointed at him. I know Nick has worked on conditional cash transfers and also on some of the other issues. And we'll let the panelists then come in, the commissioners come in on others. But Pascal first.
No, just let me take a few of these points, and of course our colleagues will also have their say. Democracy, I know. Conventional wisdom is that democracy is inevitably short-term and that new communication systems, media, social networks are great about raising issues and terrible about solving them. This is conventional wisdom. I think democracies can, and this has happened in the past, address long-term issues, provided they have their place in the domestic debate. A democracy is a way of sort of aggregating collective preferences. There are different collective preferences, individual preferences on your discount rate. Some of us have a short-term view, others have a long-term view, some groups have their own discount rate. A democratic process is a way to aggregate these different time horizons, as well as putting a coefficient on freedom, security, social justice, or animal welfare. So I think there's absolutely nothing that says that democracy is a problem. We have to nevertheless acknowledge that it's a bit more difficult to aggregate collective preferences within a democratic system than within a non-democratic system, which is why sometimes non-democratic systems in the classical sense of the term may be better at addressing the long-term issue, the sort of, you know, enlightened despotism. And there are some screens on this planet who are looking in this direction. On 2030-40, I will let another answer. On the question about multilateralism being at low ebb, true, that's what I said last year, when I was still WTO DG. I haven't changed my mind, and I'm afraid things have not improved since last year. But this is a view which we are trying to, in many ways, exit in this report, or at least in the proposals. Multilateralism doesn't work because it is very much between international institutions who themselves are the product of sovereign Westphalian nation states. And there are many reasons why multilateralism is clogged at the present time. I don't have time to expand on this. There are structural reasons. There are reasons that have to do with the rebalancing, the geopolitics and the geoeconomics of this planet. Many emerging countries have now their say, which they didn't have before, which is great, but they're not, you know, they're not always sure about what they have to say and the sort of responsibilities which go with this new weight they have around the table. And I think the exit for the moment, we all need to try and make international institutions work better, and having a sunset clause might trigger a bit of this better. But the notion that we have to go across other instruments, constituencies, stakeholders, and just in institutions is very important, including in business and civil society. Hence this coalition. And short term, I believe that that's a stream which should be much better exploited. On vested interests, that's, you know, what Europeans call now the Juncker syndrome. It's a sort of quotation by Jean-Claude Juncker, as the Luxembourg Prime Minister, who said in the European Council, "Look, guys, we know full well what we have to do, but we don't know how to be reacted if we do it." Now, that's central into this issue. Again, the solution is, in my view, and I think in the view of the Commission, to create a premium on the long term which does not exist. Hence this idea of a price, for instance, to fossil fuel subsidies removal has triggered heavy demonstrations in Nigeria. It has worked so far reasonably well in Indonesia, for instance. Now, why is it working in Indonesia and why is it not working in Nigeria? It's the same fuel, it's the same way of providing subsidies. So there's something in the way you do it, and at the end of the day, it's about convincing people. There's no way, there's, in my view at least, other road than engaging on a public debate and demonstrating the way, for instance, Nick did it on the climate change, when he transferred the climate change issue from the world of environment and science to the world of economics, and building the right number to show that if you do that, you shoot in your own foot at your cost, and the cost is X. So I think that's the way forward.
Thanks, Pascal. Nick.
Let me add just one thing on democracy and future generations. Democracies are embedded in and embodied and embody notions of human rights. And we educate our children, a long-term investment. We see that as part of their rights. We see it as part of our responsibilities. So when we think about democracy, we shouldn't think only of the particular voting structure of the current generation. We should think the way in which the rights of future generations are embodied in what we do. And they clearly are embodied in what we do. It's a question of thinking more closely as to how well we do that. On conditional transfers, this was part of our story about investing in young people. This is there are various examples of this, particularly associated with initiatives in Mexico and Brazil 15 or 20 years ago, where, for example, you get a cash transfer provided your children go to school. That's the condition. Yeah. Bolsa Familia, Bolsa Escola. They go through different names. Each time you have a change of government, they change the name to claim that it's their particular thing. But basically, the conditionality is on responsible treatment of the children. You can make it conditional on vaccination as well. And that's why we set it in the context of the investing in younger generations. Just a word on subsidies. You have to be intelligent as to how you unravel these things. You can do it over 5 or 6 years, and as you do it, you can compensate those who are particularly affected. In many countries, it's the middle class who benefit most from the fuel subsidies. If you gradually unroll them and at the same time compensate the poorest people, you can manage the story a bit better. If also you link it with better services, in northern states, Punjab, for example, and Tamil Nadu, in India, you can gradually introduce pricing for electricity, which is in this, since it's mostly coal generated, it's a fossil fuel subsidy, you can introduce prices for electricity if at the same time you provide a much better electricity service. So there are ways of managing these transitions, but they have to be managed in ways that are politically aware.
Thanks very much. Julia?
Yeah, thank you very much. First of all, just on democracy, I grew up in a country where my parents were sent to prison because they believed in a democratic system. So obviously, I still think, several of us here, so I still think we've got to try. But of course, without legal frameworks, which will help us behave better, nothing works, and certainly not democracy. And I think that's important. I want to just say to you that when the Stern report helped us look at the climate challenge, not only as scientists and as environmentalists, but as citizens of a world and as from the economic point of view, we also took that lesson in the environment world, in the natural resource world, and we're working very hard, and Nick Stern is involved with me on valuing natural capital, another way of looking at these things. On the multilateralism, Camilla, we were all in Rio together, and what everyone said there is that the system isn't working, but it wasn't as bad as what we thought, because in fact the good things that were happening in Rio were not happening in the government room, but were happening among scientists, young leaders, city leaders, conservationists, and so on. So the idea of this coalition is to organize that energy and to bring it together, to address these issues together, and we'll need facilitation help for sure, but it's totally doable. The fact that those groups got together in an organized way, bringing them together in a mega coalition, I think will work, and I want that coalition to address other issues, and they're perfectly willing to do so. I must say that, you know, having been following the international system for so many years, in the last five or so years, the presence of local leaders, the mayors' conferences and so on, has really added a new dimension where I think democracy is working better at the local level. And finally, on that last question about whether the sunset clause would not simply, and the assessment of how international institutions are doing, would not simply lead them to just focus on the assessment results rather than doing things better. Obviously, we'll have to set up terms of reference for what's expected from those institutions, and that's what we should assess, and not duplicating what others do and being more future-oriented. You're right, that could happen unless this whole sunset clause, is the fit-for-purpose idea, is not defined very well, but I think that's also doable and necessary.
Thanks very much. We'll go to a second round. You can get to show your hands.
There's a question from the gentleman over there about whether the 2030-40 idea would help with moving towards long-termism. I think the cities and companies look longer than national governments. So this was a rich and varied commission, and many of us had different views, but one of the interpretations of this one is I think the presence of cities and companies would actually help the G20 take a longer-term view.
Yeah, thank you. The gentleman with silver hair in the middle there. Thank you.
Thank you, Julian O'Halloran, BBC Current Affairs. Doesn't this issue lie behind a lot of what you have been studying? The fact that the century of growth is over, it will never be repeated, that the growth model is bust, and that the relentless pursuit of growth will lead and is leading to environmental disaster. It's an unpopular message, but politicians don't accept it. They see the short term, by and large. Unless you are more brutal in spelling out what lies behind a lot of these problems, isn't there a danger that your report will simply gather dust on shelves in the future, along with so many other well-meaning documents?
Thank you very much for the clear question and challenge to us, which we'll respond to. The gentleman in the front here.
Hello, Chris Bradford from the World Future Council again. In light of your comments on the UN duplicating across various agencies, I'd just like to know what your take on the proposal for a High Commissioner for Future Generations, which has just come out from a Secretary General report in the recent weeks. And I know that Professor Golding, you participated in some of the conversations in that.
Yeah. Any other questions, comments? The gentleman over here.
Alan Edwards, I'm from the Chartered Institute of Public Finance and Accounting. I'd like to speak in support of the Open Governance initiative that Mo spoke about and the idea of a future index in that area. I wonder, in relation to that, whether the Commission also considered the potential for introducing international public sector accounting standards, because if we're going to have an index, we need common accounting standards. Governments don't normally account on a proper basis for their liabilities, and so if we're going to look long term, we actually need to adopt that sort of approach. It may sound very dry, but pretty important if we're going to get good public sector governance.
Fortunately, Mo has been very involved in that. And Nick, I think you were responsible for UK statistics when you were in the Treasury, weren't you? So we'll throw that one at you too. The gentleman right at the back on the left. I would invite women to also raise your hands. I'm very concerned. We have a gender bias in the questions.
Bernard Mercer, philanthropy advisor. I wonder whether the Commission has considered how scrutiny could be applied to global proposals for tackling global problems. And there is an argument that there is a kind of analysis deficit. Ideas are developed and floated. We don't, for example, have a global think tank. Most think tanks are aligned with national interests and national concerns. And it seems to me this is quite an important issue because of the danger of perverse consequences, which I'm sure we could all list a lot of perverse consequences. For example, liquid biofuels as a well-known example.
Gentleman down here.
Thank you. Simon Goldsmith from Principled Sustainability. It's something that Lord Stone picked up, is that, you know, we need evidence-based policy, but increasingly I'm seeing more belief-based policy from certain countries. How do we really get over that? Because I think it's going to be a really important issue.
Okay. Anyone else on this round? Lady over here, Elizabeth. Just wait for the mic.
Elizabeth Roberts, the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. I wonder how the capacity, so often we can talk about in the field of geopolitics, the way in which certain trends are foreseeable, the rise of China or the rise of India, but there's also the capacity for unseen events to knock us seriously. Of course, one only has to think of the fall of the Soviet Union or the 9/11 or the rise or the Arab Spring, for example. Are there any ways of trying to improve our responsiveness to this sort of thing? Or is it just a method of a question of having to factor in always a measure of unpredictability in the geopolitical area?
Thank you. I'm not going to give people a second chance quite yet. The gentleman in the middle there.
Thank you. Ted Fuller from the University of Lincoln. I'm also editor of Futures Journal, SAFA. Many interests in this. You've already picked out some points such as a premium for the long-term future, the embodiment of future generations, pursuit of growth. So my question is really, is this just nudging society, or is there some fundamental shift in our relationship with the future that we need to consider?
Okay. No more questions. Well, then the gentleman here, why don't you have the last one, and we'll come back to the panel. Thank you.
Regarding corporations, I wonder if you have established some criteria for selecting corporations which join, because the Puma Corporation, of course, recently did a study, what would be the effects if they internalized all the costs of production they have so far externalized, and they found that their profits would have been reduced by three quarters, but, you know, they would still be profitable. The problem is, of course, that many corporations, if they did that exercise, would end up not being profitable at all anymore, be running at a loss. The question is, do you want corporations as members who, if they had to be what the aim is, to be, you know, sustainable, not to externalize costs anymore, would actually be extinct? Or will you make sure that the corporations who've joined are actually corporations who would still be able to survive? Otherwise, of course, they would have a big interest in trying to block the changes you're advocating for. Thank you.
Thanks. I'll give the floor first to Pascal Amy.
Yeah, on the question about, is there any guarantee that these innovative analysis and the innovative proposals which we draw from this analysis, is there any guarantee that they won't end into the drawer's cemetery? There's no guarantee at all. You will decide. It's a market test. Tons of these reports are buried in the Douro Cemetery, not the Club of Rome report, not the Brundtland report, not the Delors report that gave way to the EMU. And sometimes these things change, trigger attention, debate, and there is a sort of aftermath effect, which may not be the one which is precisely in the report, but because it has been sort of, you know, cross-fertilized, taken on a different ground by different people. What we've tried to do in the work of the Commission is not only agree on things, we sometimes had quite long and tough discussions, but agree on proposals which offer a sort of new toolbox that people can digest and use for themselves. Again, we'll see. On the UN High Commissioner for New Generations, great if there is a high coefficient of visibility and a low coefficient of bureaucracy. Should be doable. It happens sometimes. There's no insurance policy that it will work this way. On the analysis, I 100% agree with you. I think it is the responsibility of a number of international bodies or organizations to sometimes push new analytical research, work, findings beyond what the consensus of their members would let them do if they were asking for consensus. And I experienced this when I was DG of WTO, when I wrote this initiative of this sort of revolution of measuring trade in value-added instead of volumes, the way we've done it since the Middle Ages. Had I asked the General Council of WTO, can I do that? The answer probably would have been, oh, depends on what the result will be for my numbers. What the OECD does in many areas, although the OECD is governed by a body of ambassadors, which for a think tank is a bit of a weird sort of counterintuitive way of running a think tank, running it by a board of ambassadors, I think they've very often pushed analytical and research in areas where it has had a very positive effect on action. So you need this sort of independent or, let's say, de facto quasi-independent systems, and which is why one of the proposals we make is, yeah, for more of these independent institutions. Why is it becoming more difficult? Of course it's becoming more difficult because it's more complex and because, you know, the number of people who have their say is incredibly bigger than it was 20, 30, 50 years ago, and more to come in the next decades. The sort of 3 billion new middle class members, sort of what Marx called the bourgeois, which will join the existing 2 billion middle class of today. These 3 billion people, which will be there in the next 20 years, will be politically more volatile, more turbulent. There'll be more critics. It will be more difficult to have people agreeing than if they were locked in party, churches, unions, the way they were. In many ways, this is a great thing. And I personally believe that there is in this wealth of people who have a higher level of education, who care more about stability in their political system, there is a wealth of political energy provided it can be mobilized. So on this, I'm not pessimistic at all. Of course, it's more difficult, but after all, you know, if people are more clever, and in many ways I believe they are more clever, so what? That's the essential.
Thanks very much, Pascal. Mo, do you want to comment on?
Yeah, just a couple of remarks. Of course, there is a danger that the report will end up gathering dust on some shelves somewhere. It all depends really on how actively we manage to engage. That's why we are reaching out. We send the report to a lot of our colleagues for endorsements. A number of discussions will happen in different countries across the globe. We rely, I was so heartened to see also a number of you telling us about their organizations, and some people already produced some index, some people working on these issues, there are some think tanks. What is important is to connect and to work together. And this is something we need to learn in civil society, actually. Instead of working in little compartments, it need to reach and to work together, and then we're a real force in order to change. The issue of politicians not interested, unfortunately, is a challenge for liberal democracy. The fast cycles of election, really, politicians are only interested in what the tabloid's headline is tomorrow. And we need to find a solution for it, actually, because, and I tell you, I come from Africa, and democracy is getting a bad name. That's a challenge for a certain, people ask, is that the model you want to ask? Look what's happening in Washington, look what's happening there. So we have a problem. And democracy in itself, I totally believe in it. It is how we are practicing it, I think. We need to look at it. Is it the system side? But that's some long-term question. But the world around us, I think, is changing, and there are new players at the table. A lot of marginalized people are becoming a force now, economic force, loud voices. Number of educated people around the globe is increasing. We Africans now are also making a lot of noise. You say, where our place on the table? You guys ignoring us. So the world is changing around us, but the global system is unable yet to really respond to that. We still, in my view, have a dysfunctional Security Council, which doesn't represent anything. It's losing legitimacy, frankly. And we need to pay attention to all this issue. But I think the new forces there, cities are now playing a very important role. We have a huge migration taking place everywhere towards cities. There is metropolis being built everywhere. And they are being managed, actually, in a much better and more effective way, because I think the management system of cities maybe is much more simplified and less politicized than the governance of countries. You can look around you and you see cities able to make decisions and to move forward, whether in carbon or in whatever long-term issues. So this new coalition between all those people and between the civil society, which is very important now, a new force coming forward can be very effective. Business also need to be included. And I believe business is not necessarily evil. It need, maybe some of them are misguided, it needs some help. In the age of taxation, actually, I need to say something about this as a businessman. It's very regrettable that we are still see some anomalies, some people not paying taxes where it should have been paid. And the problem is that if you are a chief executive and your CFO comes to you and says, this structure minimizes your tax bill, you turn to your legal counsel and say, sir, absolutely legal. What are you going to do? The problem is that our countries have failed to go global. Our governments failed to, business gone global long time ago. Our systems are still very backward and they are not matching that. And that results in the race to the bottom, actually, and is not helping anybody. Anyway, I went out of my way maybe to discuss some other issues.
Thanks very much. Well, I'm going to give the floor to Roland, then Martin, then Julia, and then Nick, and then we'll finish off, and I think we'll then be time for lunch. You would have all deserved it.
Thank you. There was said that the century of growth is over. This is one of the statements you hear very often, but I don't believe in it because there is no reality behind it. My first question would be, how do you like to feed the 2.5 billion people which are not yet born without economic growth? How do you want to feed them? How do you want to feed the 1.5 billion people which live with less than $1 a day? How do you want to feed them? The only way would be to have a global fight for the existing output and for the existing wealth. I don't know that, I don't think that this is a viable alternative. In addition, productivity in our present manufacturing or service providing systems is increasing, which means the number of jobs will, without economic growth, will be reduced. There will be a fight for jobs. And unemployment is one of the worst possible futures you can offer to people. And thirdly, of course, how do you want to resolve some of the major problems which we address also in this report, such as education, climate change, resource efficiency, etc., without investments, future additional investments, which means you need economic growth for this. Of course, what we need is responsible growth, which means we have to look at how we distribute income, how we distribute wealth. We have to maybe not focus as much to goods only, but maybe to services for education, for the young people, for the elderly people, for the growing number of elderly people, for worldwide healthcare and health and all these kind of issues. So I think it's the wrong debate to debate whether we need growth. I think it's important to define the kind of responsible growth we need. Also, if you want to concentrate on responsible resource management, you can do it only by additional investments, by additional technology. And let me make another remark, because as Julia, I was born in a country where my father was in prison fighting for democracy. I'm a fan for democracy, but I think we need a public debate on democracy, because evidently there are so many democratic regimes and so many also more or less which are dysfunctional, and there are other functional, more or less functional democracies which can be improved. I think we have to have this public debate how we can improve the existing democratic system, because it's not all about voting alone. We need to have different governance systems, legitimacy of governance, And we need to have responsible and strong leaders, but responsible leaders also which do not look only to be re-elected or maybe to gain wealth through the power they accumulate as leaders in democracy. So democracy is certainly a value which should be defended, but I think it needs a lot of reform. And if you look at the two biggest Asian nations, one is democratic, the other one is not democratic. The performance of the democratic nation, unfortunately, is very poor compared to the non-democratic nation. So we have to make sure that democracy, where we have it, functions, and where we don't have it, gets the necessary acceptance.
I'm afraid we're running out of time, so I'm going to ask the remaining commissioners to be brief in their comments. Yep. Julia, and then Martin, and then Nick.
I have a lot of things to say, but I'll just say, and hopefully we can talk during lunch, but just about the gathering dust possibility. Of course, it's a possibility, but that's why we're doing this in this city. We'll do it in other cities. And if this is an example of the energy that exists throughout the world, there are a number of organizations that speakers mentioned that I had never heard about. Of course, I know about the World Future Council, but I didn't know about the Institute for Strategic Dialogue and so on. So this energy must exist elsewhere, and we've got to make sure that you're included in making sure that this report doesn't just gather dust. And on the last question about the companies, of course, the Puma had the appropriate leadership, and that is one of the things that is clearly needed in all of this. But the World Business Council on Sustainable Development was set up with the right ideas. And so the idea is that the C30 would come from those companies. The chairman, the new chairman to be any minute now, next month, is the chair or the CEO of Unilever, which is willing to say, I can make money and be sustainable. So I think they're good examples. We've got to start from somewhere. I'd like to talk about democracy too, but we'll do that over lunch.
Martin.
First, on the issue of governance, it's clear, as Pascal said, that it's going to be more and more challenging, there are more actors involved. And I do think we're going to have a bumpy ride, partly because it's easy for subnational actors empowered by modern technology to be disruptive, etc. So I think we have to deal with that. But I want to make two positive comments. The first is regarding economic growth. It is clear we can't end up with a world where everyone lives like present-day Americans. That's unsustainable. But on the other hand, growth has been produced in the last 20 years to a substantial degree by advanced information technology of huge benefits. And that's the kind of growth which can occur without tremendous damage to the environment or to resources. So I think we do have to have economic growth. The other thing I wanted to say, and perhaps I'm being starry-eyed here, is I think we should be hopeful about the younger generation. First of all, they are all more international in general. They are perhaps more longer term because they will be alive towards the end of a century and their children will live into the 22nd century. And so I think we can hope for them to have this longer term view. But for just that reason, it's very important that we do address the problem of youth unemployment, because if that generation gets embittered and disaffected by what's happening now, then we will lose this opportunity to engage them in pushing things in a more positive way.
Thank you very much, Martin. Nick.
Just to endorse what Roland and Martin have said, we have to break the link between consumption and production on the one hand and emissions of greenhouse gases and damage to ecological systems on the other. And we know how to do that. So it's a question of implementing that. And a big part of that story would be reduction of waste and reduction of inefficiency. Not the whole of the story. On statistics, I wasn't in charge of national statistics at the Treasury. Winston Churchill established what became the Office for National Statistics to stop individual ministries manipulating the statistics, and we established the Office of Budget Responsibility recently to stop the Treasury manipulating the revenue statistics. So what that tells me is that the institutional structures, as well as the accounting conventions, are also important, and the role of Eurostat and the UN and so on in implementing accounting conventions is very good. We have to remember the institutions as well. I was in charge of the World Bank, of the statistics at the World Bank when I was chief economist, and there I think emphasis on poverty issues changed the way statistics were presented. Emphasis on environmental issues changed the way in which statistics were presented and what they covered, and I think that was very, very valuable. I should also emphasize that publish what you pay is a principle of statistics, which is very important in tackling corruption in resource extraction and other industries. Evidence-based policy and belief-based systems. In government, we had the notion of evidence-based policy and policy-based evidence. Policy-based evidence is evidence which the minister asks you to produce in favour of the policy that he or she has already decided. I think that the more we insist and push and press for evidence-based policy, the better. I do think, I'm not sure what you mean by belief-based systems. I think the market fundamentalism and ideology that we saw, particularly in the United States and the UK, during the 80s, 90s, and the first part of this century, was indeed deeply damaging. If you meant religious-based policies, then it seems to me that founding what you do on the basis of decent moral standards, however you define them, does matter. But that, of course, can become much more narrow in some circumstances. Finally, is this nudging or is this a fundamental shift? It's a fundamental shift. If you think of what we've been saying about breaking the link between emissions and ecological damage and the growth story, that's a fundamental shift. If we think about establishing institutions which strengthen greatly the ability to think for the long term, reduce government-induced policy risk, that's a fundamental shift. If we invest in young people in a much better way than now, that's a fundamental shift. That's not just a nudge. But does it require political revolution? No, it doesn't. I think we are able to do these things with intelligent public reasoning, public discussion, in our existing frameworks. The question is, will we? And the purpose of this commission was to try to increase the probability that we will.
Thanks very much, Nick, also for rounding up with those comments on why we're here. We haven't covered everything. If Baron Peter Piot was here, he would have certainly wanted to talk about non-communicable diseases, what we're saying about pandemics, some of the issues, and other commissioners would have had other topics to focus. So I do encourage you to drill down into the report. We are very keen that you all engage in a conversation with each other, with us, in Twitter, and in other media. And also please do tell your friends, whether you like it or not, and get them to read it. As Pascal and others have said, whether this gathers dust or not is not really only up to us. We will do everything our possible, meetings like this, and we will do this around the world. And of course, the commissioners are well placed to do that in their own countries and in their own constituencies as well, and will be doing so. But it also does depend on you. It depends on whether you take this forward in conversations and how we're able to drive this forward. So thank you so much to you for coming. I do want to thank the commissioners, not only those here who've given so generously of their time, but over the last year. This has been an intense process of work, difficult, ambitious, but I'm delighted with the outcome. I think we've made massive progress, and also want to thank particularly the chair, who's clearly of the commissioners, put the most work into this. Thank you for coming. There will be an opportunity. We haven't addressed all the questions that were posed. I'm very conscious that there are a couple that are still hanging, but we will be having a sandwich lunch afterwards, to which you're all invited, and we encourage you to engage in conversation with us and with each other individually as well. So thanks to you all for coming, and thanks to the commissioners too.